Hi there, listeners.
Hello.
So we are saying hello at the start of the episode because we have got a Patreon page and we would love you to get involved.
What's a Patreon page, Ben?
Well, Barry, a Patreon page is a way that long-term and new listeners can contribute to us financially, but not as consumers, but as patrons of something they love and adore and want to support so that it can grow and grow.
That's a very clever way of putting a spin on a capitalist enterprise, Ben.
That absolutely is. Off to the gulags with you, Barry. I'm sure as long-term podcast listeners, you'll know all about what Patreon is. Basically, it is a way of allowing me and Barry to make a little bit of filthy lucre out of this. We've made over 75 hours of podcasting now, and we're delighted that so many of you enjoy it. It obviously takes up a fair bit of our time researching, editing, recording the things, and booking guests. And we want to be able to keep doing that, and Patreon enables that, and we want to grow it so we can do one-off, non-canon episodes, do live shows, and even one day write a book based on all our research.
If you go on there, you can donate everything from $2 up to $50, and all of those different levels have rewards, be it just a friendly shout-out on social media, and we'll probably shout you out after an episode as well, to being allowed to suggest topics for episodes, come on and judge an episode, or even, within reason, host us in your house. I mean, we're not going to go to Tuvalu. I'm sorry, the listenership in Tuvalu. We don't want to alienate you, but we'd let you host us. Let you host us.
The arrogance of it. Yeah,
you could benefit from hosting us in your front room, recording an episode, and Ben will even do a special curated stand-up set for you and your friends.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, when I say that as a goal, I'll try and bring along one of my other mates who are a comic as well, because you'll get a hell of a lot of me during the episode. We're after, by and large, the money that you're not going to miss. Essentially, we're asking you to do the equivalent of buy us a coffee, buy us a pint, buy us a meal, or buy us a 1959 bottle of Jack Daniel's whiskey. Yeah. Or even buy a 1959 a bottle of Macallan whiskey. I just remember that I am married to a Scottish woman. And help us go towards creating more excellent podcasting for your ears.
A good way of looking at it, I know some podcasts have put it this way. If we've made 75 episodes and you've liked 75 of them, you could give us $1 per episode. So subscribe. I don't know what way you do that, but maybe donate to us on Patreon for
a month and a half.
A month and a bit. Or if you've listened to the odd one here and there and you decide, okay, well, I think that's probably worth $5, just do it once off and then don't keep... Whichever way you describe to do it. Subscribe to us forever. We're like Amazon Prime. You can never leave.
Yeah. And also, we will turn up on your doorstep unsolicited with baked beans and a Rolling Stones record and some Brillo pads. Barry has just pointed up an excellent point of order. We need to look into how you can do one-off subscriptions as well.
Yes.
But for now, not an option because that is how capitalism works.
Go to
patreon.com/worstfootforward.
Or you can find the link to the Patreon page at the very top of our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com.
Marvellous stuff. Now, onwards with some outrageous zero worship. Arise, good sir and lady listeners of the realm of podcastum, as we welcome you to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we discover the best of the worst. I am Sir Benjamin of the Veld. Chivalry is dead, they say, but who killed it? Was it the butler in the drawing room holding a door open for Miss Peacock, only to slam it back onto her face at the last minute? Perhaps it was Professor Plum, whose kind donations to his own orphanage was nothing more than a front, enabling access to harvest the organs of the vulnerable for his own dastardly plans. Or was it Colonel Mustard, leading his troops in the battle, only to turn at the last minute to run and hide in a cave, whilst they were left exposed to the slaughter? Either way, we're going to do our best to hook chivalry up to some jump leads and restart its faded, battered, blue and charred heart. Or my name is not Sir Benjamin of the Veld, and with me, riding along on a three-legged Shetland alpaca by my side, it's Squire Barrington McStay.
Your Sancho Panza.
The Sancho Panza to my Don Quixote.
I like the fact that you were talking about the death of chivalry and went on an extended delve into the backstory of the Cluedo character.
Yeah.
At one point, point, I think I tuned you out for about 5 seconds, came back and went, I've lost the thread here.
Yeah, that's what I felt like I was writing the introduction, mate.
Well, it's lovely. Yeah. It's like a little, like one of those knight's quests where you go on little side quests. Where the objective was to introduce me, but you did it via, what's the name of the building in Cluedo?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Death Hall?
Dr. Black, isn't that his name?
It is that Cluedo follows the tropes, that's the word I was looking for, of horror movies, that the first victim, and indeed the only victim, is a person of colour. Which is...
Touché, Ben.
Oh, no, I'm just saying, that's what Cluedo does. It should not be proud of itself.
Yeah. We should introduce our guest, who's sitting very politely beside us. Our guest this week has been described by the Scotsman as like a very tall, funny, excited child, somewhere between reincarnated Viking and gamekeeper on a country estate, and having performed stand-up for nearly a decade, he is also a project officer at Museum of London Archaeology. He has appeared on BBC4's The Big Dig, supported Hal Cruttendon on tour, and has been a cast member of the excellent Nightmare Live alongside several previous podcasts. He has toured the UK with his show Ask an Archaeologist, which is now a tremendously successful podcast, and in his spare time he dresses up in medieval armour and lets people hack at him with swords. For fun, apparently. From trenches to trebuchets, cross sections to crossbows, he's a man for all seasons, especially if those seasons took place in the past. It's Paul Duncan McGarrity.
Hello.
Hi. It's so nice to finally meet you. Straight off the bat, what happened when we organised this last time, 5 months ago, to interview?
Well, what happened normally in these situations is other people's work gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in that instance, Ben had to pull out at a very late date. Very late time of when we were going to do the recording, which really wouldn't have been much of a bother, except what was I dressed in when I turned up for the recording?
You walked down the corridor towards my flat as I opened the door, dressed in chainmail and
full,
a helmet.
A full 11th century suit of armour.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I like to make an effort and have the ambient sound, you know, a completely audio medium. And I thought, do you know what? I'll come visually prepared.
Yeah. Whereas I'm doing our own Foley work this week.
So, no.
You had gone to quite a lot of effort.
I had. I had put some work in. And
Ben has suffered quite a few forfeits since then.
I'm really sorry, guys. Yeah. Not as sorry as that 11th century knight who still wants his clothes back, though.
Yeah.
Where did you borrow it from?
Borrowed nowhere. I own that.
Oh, you own that?
I own two sets of armour.
I thought you had taken it from, like,
two
work.
Sets?
Yeah.
What, kind of like dinner and then cocktail?
I own an 11th century and a 14th century suit of armour.
Oh, what, right.
Like a Windows upgrade?
Well, like...
Armour XP.
You know, the 11th century stuff is... It's fine, but it's not going to stop an axe at full speed. So you need to have the 14th in reserve.
Just for times of need. Now, you do fighting.
Yes.
Like medieval.
Yeah. I'm off at the moment because I tried to block a sword with my hand and had a finger... what's the technical term? Snapped off.
Yeah, at an angle that was obtuse.
You know the hand motion that surfers sometimes do to show that things are tubular?
Yeah.
When the finger is sticking out one way and the thumb is sticking out the other. That, but when I was trying to make a fist.
So you just spent like several days of your life walking around with people thinking, wow, this guy thinks everything is gnarly.
I was quite radical for 2 weeks.
And by the
could
way...
not give directions for the longest time.
Yeah, because I always it's like, oh, you want to turn right, why are you pointing with your little finger? I'm a weirdo.
But Paul was committed to medievalism, so you got your finger fixed by a barber surgeon.
Yeah.
With no antibiotics and a lot of pitch.
You know something interesting about barber surgeons?
I'd love to hear something interesting about barber surgeons.
So they split, obviously, in the city of London. They used to be the one sort of honourable company of barber surgeons, and then they split into the surgeon's company and the barber's company. But when they did, they wanted to make sure that the lines were well, you know, well respected. So there is in the constitution of the barber's no member will perform surgery.
Right.
But delightfully, within the surgeon's company, no member will cut hair.
So if you need to get at someone's scalp to perform brain surgery...
You better goddamn make sure you have a hairdresser on hand. I love that they were so petty. They were like... don't cut into people's skin. What, you don't do a fringe?
Do you imagine the forbidden love story between the son of a barber and the daughter of a surgeon? Wanting to work in the other field. No, we are barber families.
That's what the musical Hair was originally about.
I always thought it was lovely that if it had gone the other way and, you know, you had to a state-funded hairdressing system, but like you could go in and there was just a bunch of tables in a room that they hired and it's like, are you waiting, love? What is it? Appendicitis? Come on. Are you going to be for the weekend?
The National Hair Service.
Yeah, National Hair Service. Good.
So, Paul...
Hair Force.
Bravo.
Yes, we like to ask our guests what they are worst at.
Focusing on things that I've been paid to do.
This is all walks of paid life.
Yeah, love watching a deadline approach.
Was it Douglas Adams said he loves deadlines?
He loves the sound they make when they whistle past.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why I do high adrenaline, high intensity sports and things like that.
Because you must focus.
Oh my goodness, the fastest thing I've ever learned was boxing, because if you don't, you get punched in the head.
So we need to introduce some sort of sense of jeopardy to menial tasks in your day-to-day life.
Not just menial tasks, like the job I'm paid for.
So if there was someone literally standing over you saying, if you don't complete this on time, we will chop a hand off.
Yeah, or if there was just someone approaching closer, like every...
the sound, the mastermind music playing.
Yeah.
And a guy in a Grim Reaper costume.
Yeah.
Slowly walking across the office.
They get so many reports in on time. Just a screensaver that's a memento mori.
Is there a stereotype about archaeologists apart from Indiana Jones?
No, the stereotype about archaeology is Indiana Jones or the Time Team stereotype, where we're all in knitwear, we all like real ale, we all... And the truth of the matter is, it's very close to the...
close to both. Indy in a cardigan.
Yeah, alternatively, someone using a bullwhip to get real ale off the bar.
Yeah.
Which is impressive.
Yeah, but only when you get it done on the first go. If you're doing it on the 10th go and there's just loads of fragments of glass on the ground and half your team are trying to put them back together to go, what a wonderful example of late 20th century glassware.
I think there's a
Indiana Graham Jones and the Holy Ale.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
I genuinely think there's a small proportion of archaeologists who got into it because they wanted to understand how societies used to work so they can work out how society works now.
And eventually I'll be able to meet girls.
Yes, exactly. That's it. Queen Nefertiti was a real wonder.
Yeah, so you work your way up going, right, so I've met girls who are made of bone, but the bones aren't connected to each other. Mm. And then you work your way up to bones that are connected.
Yeah, and then you just got to flesh out that knowledge.
Lovely. Right, I think that's us spent with this badinage. On with the main rump of the show.
Banter done.
So
what got me was the amount of work you put into the introduction, to be honest. Like, we did a podcast for 2.5 years and I don't think you wrote anything close to that in any of the episodes.
There's a new sheriff in town.
So this week, listeners, we are going to be talking about the world's worst knight with a K. Because obviously
we'll save the one without a K.
That's easy. Knight of the Long Knives. Done. Although no, Knight of the Long Knives was where he killed lots of Nazis. Kristallnacht. That's the one.
I was going to say, technically, some Nazis died.
Barry, off you go.
Capturing knights, much better idea than killing them. Because you get good ransom out of them, because they generally tended to be wealthy people.
Mm. But was it bounty? No, there's another word for it, isn't there?
Cashel? Oh, no, that's just bounty, the absorbent.
If you wanted to be good at jousting, you wanted armour that was pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. So basically, like, weigh you down in place.
Yeah.
So that meant you wanted to have lots of money. So the people who were really... the people who were very good at jousting were the people who could afford all the fancy equipment. Yeah. So it was just
like
annoying. It's like tennis.
Golf, cycling, just yachting.
Did they use like little cranes and things?
Yeah, little cranes. Little cranes with a horse.
No, wait, for the
little
horse.
Little cranes with a horse?
No, to get you on the horse.
And then a higher crane for the knight. And then they dropped everything into the lists. You couldn't be knighted until your armour was buckled in a fight. It's one of the ideas behind knighted. You had to actually, do some damage, have fought somebody. So that's one of the thoughts as to why when someone's getting knighted, typically you have a sword placed on the shoulders, sort of symbolic of them still buckling their armour today. Even better, though, was in the old days when they used to follow that with a slap in the face. I don't really know what that was meant to symbolise.
Do you know where you stand? I'm the king.
Yeah.
Do you remember our episode with Spring where she said that there was an old Jewish tradition that when young girls got their first period, their mothers would slap them in the face?
Oh, yeah,
so I presume
right.
that at the same time they were ennobling those girls as well.
Yeah, or a lot of knights got knighted on the day of their first period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike, you're such an ennobler.
I read about chivalric orders as well, some of the different orders of knighthood you could be a member mm-hmm. of. Ermine, the Order of Ermine, formed by John V of Brittany in the 1380s, the first order that allowed women into it, apparently. The Order of the Dragon, the Order of the Blood of Jesus Christ, the Order of the Golden Fleece, the Order of Seraphim, the Order of St. George for the Defence of the Immaculate Conception, and my favourite one...
Wait, for the Defence of the Immaculate Conception? Yeah, you're slapping away penises.
God's penis.
Don't ruin it! It's immaculate!
This is reserved for one deity.
Yeah, and God's penis is there going, I'm just trying to buckle your armour. That's all I'm doing.
God's penis arrives and goes, you're alright, you're on the list. My favourite couple of chivalric orders are the Order of the Stoat and the Ear. I'm not entirely sure how those two go together.
It started in a pub.
Yeah. And the Order of the Elephant, which is a Danish order of chivalry set up in the late 17th century. And they tend to give it to heads of state and royalty. So this is the one you want to be in because it's got the Queen and Prince Philip, Emperor Akihito, Haile Selassie, Churchill, Nelson Mandela, a couple of non-heads of state they let in as well. They had Maersk McKinney Muller, the guy who founded the Maersk shipping industry, and Niels Bohr. So that's a good club to be in.
That's one hell of a dinner party right there. Well, I wouldn't seat Nelson Mandela next to Winston Churchill.
It might be a little awkward.
I had our Knights Hospitaller in the family.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because they've changed it to sort of like if you do good for the Catholic Church, they'll make you a member of the Order of the Knights Hospitaller. And yeah, we had one about great-great-granddad or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where does the word hospitaler come from? Why is it an ER on the end of what we know is the building where sick people go?
That's what they were doing. So it was Knights Templar and Knights Hospitaller. Kind of like doing two different things. The Templars were looking after the people on a jolly, and the hospitaler were like, you are sick. Come on. Everyone Christian. That's an important note.
Yeah. A little footnote to all of the stuff we say.
These were old school fascists.
I read about degradation as well. So if you were a bad knight, you got degraded. Yeah. The last account of someone that I could find being degraded was Francis Mitchell. And he was a guy in the 1600s who had a monopoly on licensing of inns during the reign of James I. And he basically abused that power and was impeached by Parliament in 1621, fined, imprisoned, and degraded. So he was taken to Westminster Hall, had his spurs broken and thrown away. His belt was cut. His sword was broken atop his head, hopefully flat side down.
Yeah, no, they smashed them over their skulls.
And he was pronounced no longer a knight but a knave, and he was marched to the Tower through the streets and jailed. Yeah, it's not quite as epic when they do it these days, but other more recent people who've lost their knighthoods include Fred the Shred Goodwin, the head of RBS, Robert Mugabe, Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on. Mussolini was a knight.
Yeah.
Not just Mussolini, but Nicolai Ceausescu as well.
Might well come to him very shortly.
Oh, might we? Marvellous.
And Quisling, the head of the Nazi favouring government in Norway, was also in a CBE, had his retracted as well.
Which is where the word Quisling comes from.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought Quisling was like an ancient medieval word, but it's not.
It's for that guy.
Yeah, it's for a child friendly version of Trivial Pursuit.
Or all of the Quislings are dead.
I read about some rules for being a knight. Between 900 and sort of 1200 or so, you basically followed these rules called the Peace and Truth of God. This was continental Europe. They had religious sanctions that they would impose on the nobility. So basically the monks and the priests were making sure those naughty knights weren't too naughty. So some samples of these were don't attack the clergy unless they're committing a crime. Don't kill or steal any livestock unless you need to eat. No robbery, no whipping, no kidnapping random people.
No whipping.
No arson unless there's an enemy inside the building you're setting fire to. No attacking women unless they've committed misdeeds against you.
Doesn't this feel like there was a first draft?
Yeah.
There was a bunch of some knights and they went, whoa, what if there's someone I don't like in there?
But there's no arson, okay? There's just, hands down, no arson allowed.
I need to get a man who's pissed me off out.
Okay, okay. If there's a guy inside the building you don't like, you can burn the building down.
All right,
any other objectives? Okay, arson's in. Finally,
what if I like fire and it's cleansing nature?
Okay, let's say if you're cold. If it's cold, you can also commit arson.
He's burning a witch, arson.
No, we do that. The priests are allowed to burn the witches.
Okay, just checking.
And no ambushing during Lent is the last one on the list.
No ambushing during Lent.
The rest of the year, it's fine. Lent, no. No surprises.
Whoa, what are you doing? Shrove Tuesday last week, lad.
The Knights of the Round Table.
We dance whenever we're able.
Those ones. I read about some of the lesser known Knights of the Round Table. Obviously, everyone will have heard of Lancelot and Galahad and Gawain and all of those. Have you heard of Dagonet?
No.
He was Arthur's court jester.
he's the one with the coconuts, right?
He wanted to be a knight, so he battered his own shield to show that he'd had his armor buckled so he could be knighted. Oh. But he used to run away from fights, and the others knighted him as a joke, basically, to do him down. There were two knights called Sir Iwain or Ivan, maybe Sir Iwain. There was Sir Iwain and Sir Iwain the Bastard, so you can tell the two apart. And my favorite one is Sir Gareth. Who is Gawain's brother?
Who was IT support?
Yeah. Gareth is IT in the red. He's one of the red tops in Star Trek. He's one of the skimmed milk in Star Trek.
Oh no!
Because he gets knighted and dies in the same story in the Mort d'Arthur. That's it.
Nice.
I was going to talk about Ceausescu before I get to my main candidate. Yeah, you're right. He was one of those that the British government thought they should give a knighthood to. So he was the leader of communist Romania from 1965 to 89. Yeah. And, I mean, he was a horrendous dictator. He ran the state using a secret service, like spying on people, the Securitate, mass surveillance, press control.
Mum and Dad's favourite holiday destination before I was born.
Romania?
Communist Romania.
Communist Romania.
Yeah, we used to have a Yugo.
What's a Yugo?
My mum's an old trot.
She was a big fan of Ceausescu's. Maybe she was one of those who campaigned for the knighthood.
I'm going to say probably not, but we definitely supported their economy.
What's a Yugo? Is it a van?
No, it's a little blue car.
Okay.
Well, it doesn't have to be blue.
Oh, like the Lada as well.
Yeah.
Ceausescu was not great on human rights, built up huge oil debts, and in order to pay that, he exported most of the country's agricultural output in the 80s, leading to rationing, and had this massive cult of personality, just basically photos of him everywhere, but photos of him from like 20 years ago.
Hey, we've all had a publicity shot that we don't want to let go.
Yeah. By the way, Ceausescu used to go bear hunting, but with drugged up bears, so they'd send out some people with tranquilizers before he got there.
Sorry, I need to clarify. Tito was my mum's favourite.
She'd be really unhappy.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Oh, yeah, because Yugo's from Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And also, Tito was great because Tito was the bad boy of the Communist Empire because he was never part of the Warsaw Pact and he was never part of Communist.
He never got to see him with his five brothers, though, Jackie and Germaine. Yeah,
I was thinking, oh, Ceausescu sounds horrible. Oh, no, it was Tito.
I mean, for all the stuff that Ceausescu does, his wife got people to write scientific papers for her that she would then pass off as her own. Oh. And she travelled the world as this, like, scientific figure gaining accolades from universities and places all over the planet. But he's not my choice for the world's worst knight. My choice is Ulrich von Liechtenstein.
From A Knight's Tale.
Yes, correct. Oh. Except the actual dude. He lived about in the sort of the 13th century, 1200, 1275, something like that, in Germany / Styria, which is now Austria. And he wrote an autobiographical work called Frauendienst, or this in the service of ladies, and
it's already a knob.
Yeah. Oh, well, you just wait. He spent 4 years as a page to a noble woman who he really fancied, but he thought, I've got to be a knight so I can win her heart. So he went and, by the way, when he was servant, some of the things he would do, he would bring her flowers and drink her sink water after she'd washed herself.
Oh.
To really, like, prove his love. He was knighted by Leopold of Austria. So he came back and said, I'm now a knight and I'm going to prove I love you. And she said, nah, it's not good enough. So he wrote her a love song and she rebuffed him again because he had an unsightly lip, apparently. Maybe he had a hair lip or sort of cleft palate or certainly something bad enough that he went out of his way to get surgery. Yeah.
When was he alive again?
In the 1200s.
Jeez, that guy is committed.
Yeah, he sought out the finest doctor or physician he could to get it repaired. So he got this fixed for her, came back. Nope, still not good enough. On another occasion, it turned out...
Now you're dying of septicemia in the face.
Yeah. On another occasion, they were sort of alone together, but he was too shy to speak to her. So she ripped out a lock of his hair to provoke him into speaking for some reason. Yet another attempt to gain her affection, he sent her news that he had actually cut off a finger for her out of love. She said she didn't believe the messenger, so sent the messenger back. And the messenger returned with the actual severed finger from Ulrich von Lichtenstein.
Oh, wow.
So he went proper, you know, Van Gogh with it at this point. Whose heart wouldn't melt for Ulrich at this point? Apparently this noblewoman's. Mm. So he went touring Southern Europe to try and really become famous and irresistible for his achievements. But he did more of these tourneys, but in disguise as Queen Venus. So he was going around dressed as a lady, but competing in nightly tournaments.
Oh, baby.
At one point, a lady asked
Hang on,
him,
so he wasn't in night.
He was doing a drag act.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One of the articles I read about him doing this tour of Europe, turns out he stopped by to visit his actual wife while doing this.
I love it when those stories, like, because that's
it's a throwaway detail.
Yeah, they never get the stories right in the medieval period. Like, they haven't quite worked out how to tell a full story.
When he got back, the noblewoman said, "Still not good enough, Ulrich." So, I mean, I'd be beginning to think maybe she's not worth it. But no, Ulrich, she forced him to sleep outside the gates of her castle in the rain, for some reason among a crowd of lepers. She then eventually relented, let him climb up by a bedsheet in sort of proper Rapunzel-y type style. And she congratulated him and told him that she's finally going to sleep with him. Just one last proof of devotion, climb back down the bedsheet and back up one more time. Just no big deal, you've already done it once, you can do it again. Climb down the bedsheet, and she probably let go of the sheet and told him to go on a sea voyage. He did that, came back. This point she goes, "You know what, I've been really unfair to you. Let's actually hook up." And he goes, "No, you know what, it's fine," and left her. At the end of the book he writes, he basically says, "She did an awful thing. And so I left her." And that's kind of like the end of the story. You're like, oh, like, you've done all this setup, but there's no punchline to this.
She broke wind in bed.
Yeah.
Like, no!
Could have been anything.
You know the finger, the sign of devotion?
Yeah, yeah.
And not even close to my favourite medieval romance gift.
What is?
Roger Mortimer.
Uh-huh.
At the during the nobles' uprising, was fighting Simon de Montfort, captured Simon de Montfort, and sent his wife a present, which was Simon de Montfort's head with Simon de Montfort's testicles stitched to the forehead. Because he's like, "I know my wife. I know what she's going to love."
Yeah, and she likes her heads accessorized.
Yeah, I just like the idea that he had them positioned so that they nestled in the eye sockets.
So if he wanted to talk to you, he had to tilt one side or the other.
Teabagging himself for eternity. Now, the problem that you've come across there is that you've chosen someone who was a knight at a time when knights made sense.
Yeah, right.
I have chosen Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex.
Yay! We've talked about he's a friend of the show.
He is a regular dickhead.
So Robert Devereux, well known throughout the lands for having a square beard.
Very hipster.
Yeah.
As in, like, the sort of things that pharaohs...
Yeah, it just came straight off his head, and it just was like... And it even gets mentioned in, I believe, it's Henry V. Henry V was written when he was heading off to Ireland, to go on, which we'll come to later. And then Julius Caesar was written next, and it's kind of like... So Henry V is all like, "Good luck," in the background, and Julius Caesar's all like, "Oh, let's distance ourselves from that guy." Yeah. So basically, he lived from the 10th of November to 1565 until the 25th of February 1601. Short life, probably gives away what went wrong.
Spoilers!
Who did he annoy? Elizabeth I. What did she do? Well, we all know. So he was really keen on being a knight, but had missed the historical boat. essentially, he is right. Can you imagine something worse than the guy who would still talk about how awesome secondary school was? The one thing worse than that is the guy who talks about how awesome secondary school was, but who was never there. Didn't attend that school.
And he means secondary school several centuries ago.
Yeah, and he's like, "Guys, it was just so good.
Yeah,
we should all do knight things." But unfortunately, the invention of gunpowder was somewhat making the knight an irrelevant force on the battlefields.
And they had those really big crossbows as well, like the really powerful crossbows that could pierce or arbalests
and all that sort of stuff. So he's coming at it way too late. But he's a hipster. He's got the square beard, and it's the equivalent of going into a cafe now and writing all of your thoughts on a typewriter. Except he wants to bring knights back.
Essex.
Yeah, I love Essex.
Which bit of Essex?
I don't know, but in my head, every time I read about stuff that he's doing, I imagine Joey Essex.
Yeah.
Right. That is, I didn't really think it through. All the way through this. So he took part in Francis Drake's English Armada. That's right, the English Armada.
Oh.
Yes, the one that took place a year after the Spanish Armada that we don't talk about because it failed. he'd been expressly told by the Queen not to go. But he spat his dummy out, which you'll hear a lot.
He liked doing that, didn't he?
Yes.
Not doing what she told him.
She went, listen, Robert, don't go to Spain.
I'm just off to Spain.
No, Robert, don't go to Spain.
But I've booked the flights.
I've expressly said, what,
listen,
flights?
If we don't.
Oh my God, which?
Oh, the knight's going, can I burn him now?
Yeah. Is it arson? So he actually distinguished himself during the early parts of his battles. He was, at the start of his career, quite a successful military campaigner. In 1596, he distinguished himself by capturing Cadiz, which actually bankrupted them briefly, which is, he did very well. He launched a crushing blow. He then tried to capture a Spanish treasure fleet in the Azores in 1597. The expedition not only failed, and this is a really great one, he was told not to go on it. Now, I'm just after the Azores. Stop it!
We booked the boat. Yeah.
Good, I'm glad you got by boat this time.
I get my timetable really early in the year, so I just book everything in.
Yeah, but there was a very important reason as to why he was told not to go on this expedition. Because he had the whole of the British Navy.
Oh.
And while he was away, failing to capture the Spanish fleet, he left England open to attack from the Third Armada. He's just like, I'm off. Are you not going to watch out for the... Nope, they'll be fine. I don't imagine the Spanish will try anything.
It's equivalent when you go on holidays and you try to leave a light on, a timer or something like that. It's like he's gone, I'm going to not leave the TV or something. I'm going to put the TV on the front lawn with the door open.
Yeah. I've also, you know that family down the road that's a bit dodgy? I'm going to let them know we're out.
Yeah. like they're our key guardians. Yeah.
Bye. Bye. We're going to be gone 2 weeks. Bye.
I'm taking the Armada with us.
The Spanish launched the Third Armada, which is foiled by... Anyone want to guess?
The water rally.
Nope. Bad weather again.
Really?
Yes, all three armadas were stopped by storms.
Yeah.
And people wonder why we as a nation talk about the weather. In 1599, he was made Lord Lieutenant of...
My country.
Ireland.
Yeah.
Not that they asked the Irish.
why would you?
And he was sent to put down an uprising by the Earl of Tyrone.
Yep. Hugh O'Neill.
Yeah, Hugh O'Neill. Lovely stuff. They sent 16,000 troops. It was the largest expeditionary force ever sent to Ireland. The English were not mucking around.
Yeah.
Some of those troops were recruited from audiences at theatres, in that they waited for the play to start, surrounded the theatres, and as they came out, everyone of a certain age was told, oh, you're in the army now.
It's like nowadays we have ads for the British Army and the TA before films in cinemas.
Yeah, but yeah.
But it's then someone steps through the screen and grabs you and brings you back.
Yeah. How do you think of the Middle East? Afghanistan. Ah.
3 years later, you come back. Where have you been?
Deadpool 2 and then a whole other thing.
The rising in Ireland was really, it was a properly dangerous point for the English as well, because there was a French fleet coming as well. So they basically landed at Kinsale. Spoiled yet again by weather.
It's amazing. It's like fog. Every time someone comes near this country with a boat, they're like, oh. The last person really who had good weather was William the Bastard.
Yeah.
or otherwise known as William the Conqueror, the man who proves how hard you have to work to change your nickname.
Yeah. You got something to prove, William? No! England.
I'm going to go to England.
The other thing with Ireland as well, of course, is that under Elizabeth I, England was a Protestant country, and you've got Ireland as a Catholic country. Mm. The biggest empire at the time was Catholic Spain. So big old pincer movement coming to get us.
And the Earl of Ulster was an earl, so he was one of those noblemen who was sort of living in kind of the similar fashion to some of the English nobles, and they'd been to court, some of these Irishmen. So they were people with a lot of wealth and power.
Thank goodness for the weather, otherwise we'd all be speaking Gaelic right now.
Yeah. Oh, what a world.
So they weren't mucking around when they landed with the 16,000 troops. And he said he was going to go to Ulster and face Tyrone, which I find is the most irritating part about talking about anything from sort of like the medieval period and early modern period. Tyrone was in Ulster, where Essex met him. Met what? Which one's a person and which one's the place?
Yeah.
He landed in Southern Ireland, yeah, instead of Ulster, where he said he'd go because he told the Queen something and he did the opposite because that's what he did. And what he did in Southern Ireland is he found a lot of people who were happy with them being there or sort of like not totally against it. And he just marched around for ages, meeting people who were already on his side, wasting funds and having expensive displays of chivalry.
She's in the country next door. She won't be here for a bit. Let's have a house party.
His time in Ireland can be summed up in the following sentence. He lost two important battles and then signed a treaty. By the end of his time in Ireland, though, he had done one amazing thing. Half of the knights in England had been created by the Earl.
Oh, wow.
He loved knights so much, he made more knights. He made more knights that year than the Queen.
Did he have the power to do that?
Yes, he did. Because he had an army behind him.
Right.
That's what his thinking was. He was kind of like, I'm out in the field, I've got an army, I'm going to make some knights. And that's what kind of attracted people to his cause in Ireland. There was a bunch of young nobles, or like people who were gentry, and they went over there, and he was like, I like the cut of your moxie. Not the sentence, but there you go. But on the 24th of September, 1599, he threw an absolute hissy fit. And he sailed back to England, rode as far as he could to the Queen's residence at the time, and broke into her bedchamber where she partially dressed. Some people think he was going to try and seize the crown, but the Queen managed to talk him down. Then she had him arrested.
I like to imagine it's the scene in The Empire Strikes Back when Vader has his helmet off and someone comes in to talk to him. Walking in on Queen Elizabeth at the age of nearly 70 in the late 1500s in her room, not fully dressed.
So she basically said to him, look, right, calm down, I'm going to get dressed. We'll talk about this in a bit. He never got to speak to her again.
Yeah, she pressed the button under her desk.
He gets confined to York House, doesn't learn his lesson. He's still alive at this point, which is astonishing for what he has done. He broke it. No one has been in that room like that, and he's got away with it. Does he learn his lesson? No. He starts conspiring with James VI of Scotland. On the 5th of June 1600, he was tried and convicted, and he was deprived of public office. His main income came from a monopoly of sweet wines. And he lost that after his release in August 1600. He was no longer making money out of sweet, sweet liquor. Furious that he doesn't have his money anymore, he began to fortify Essex House, which is on the Strand.
Oh, yes.
Which I love.
Having previously learned to fortify wines.
Yes, so you've got fortified wines to fortified houses. I love the idea of him fortifying it, like, doom, doom, doom. What are you doing there, Essex? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I've got all these wine barrels I don't need anymore, so I'm just building a casual barricade.
He launches an attack from his house. His thinking is the people of London will be on his side and will gather to his cause.
Mm. What residence is she in? Where is she? In the Palace of Westminster or in Hampton Court, or where would she be?
I can't remember at the time, but I think she was resident in London. And so he was aiming for...
Because that's really, it's just down the Strand from, say, if she was in St. James's Palace. Like,
that's it, but he's
a few hundred yards away.
He gets barred at Ludgate Hill. Right, so he makes it to Ludgate Hill, and they're like, stop it! Right? Obviously, before his attack, you already know this, he hired the Lord Chamberlain's men at the Globe to perform the Richard II deposition scene, which, if you think about it this way, he is such a bad knight that he jeopardised the writing of the following plays. If they had been shut down, we would not have had Othello, Lear, Macbeth, Winter's Tale and The Tempest. It's like he didn't know they were coming.
Should have known better. He could have saved so many school children from studying King Lear, though.
Stepfather was injured in the skirmish, so he withdrew and went back to his house and was like, we'll try again. In a bit. What's really interesting is there were two guys who were actually part of his attempted coup that you might recognise the name of. John Wright and Robert Catesby.
Oh, the gunpowder plotters.
Gunpowder plotters.
Yeah.
Good lord.
Because
a dry run.
There's nothing like getting a take, which is great because that means they plotted against two monarchs.
Yeah. That's like one of those stories where, well, it turns out this guy was on a watch list, but we missed him. how did you, Catesby, wandering into the House of Parliament with a barrel smelling of gunpowder? You're like, Isn't he that guy from that coup from like 3 years ago? Do you remember? Isn't he? He looks very similar. His beard's a bit different, but maybe he just looks like him.
Ah, he'll be fine. He's fine.
Yeah, let me just check the CCTV charcoal drawings.
He said that the people of London would rave outside. What the people of London instead did was what the people of London still do when something weird happens. Look down and pretend it's not happening. Essentially, everyone shut their windows and he started riding through the centre of London. As he got closer and closer into the centre, fewer and fewer people were behind him as more and more young gentlemen were like, oh, this is going badly. I'm just going to go down this corridor for no reason. I'm just going to take my horse for a... Where are you going? Just nowhere near here. I was never with the man. Me and my horse were drinking here all afternoon. Essex and four other leaders were beheaded. And the
really
other
soon after?
Yeah,
like 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, I think when you march on London, you don't get to like, hey, I did not.
Due
I
was process.
Saying, didn't mean to... Oh.
Hang on, you have the right to remain silent. Let me help you with that.
So Essex and four of the leaders were beheaded. And what happened to the other conspiracists, do you think?
They went through to the next round.
Yes, gunpowder. They were fined.
Oh, nice.
So a little fine.
They got clamped. Yeah. Everyone got clamped and then he was left in his car in the compactor.
A little yellow sticker on the windscreen of his horse.
Yeah.
So I genuinely think he's the worst knight. He tried to be a knight after knights were a thing. He launched multiple failed campaigns after a very promising start. He made more knights than they needed.
Yeah.
And he tried to attack the queen, the person that he was supposed to be looking after. And even that he couldn't get right.
It's like everything he touched turned to like madcap adventures.
Yeah.
With no positive outcome.
And again, if you just imagine his execution as he goes up to the block, and now just imagine it's Joey Essex.
Two very notable eggs to begin with. Mm. Firstly, Sir Victor Robert Colquhoun Dill. And he was a gentleman who went to Eton.
Okay.
He went to Sandhurst.
Mm. When was this?
He served in World War II.
Okay.
After World War II, he was quite the jack of all trades and the master of none.
Hmm.
He tried to be an actor, primarily in a show called Funny Face at the Prince's Theatre, but that didn't work out for him. He ended up being a garage attendant, a sandwich bar assistant, and a waiter in Putney. Yeah. This is a knight of the realm, gentlemen.
Amazing. How did he end up there? Was it one of those, like, family has no money?
Precisely
that.
Got into
Sandhurst and Eton because of...
The name. Yeah. And his worst infamy was that he served 9 months in prison for horse switching.
Horse switching?
Yes, he replaced...
Those are some massive cups.
Yeah.
Where's the horse?
Words, the cleverest thing is he takes the massive cups up and just goes, clippity-clop, clippity-clop with them. So he replaced a horse called Santa Ana with a speedier horse called Francasal and bet £6,000 on it winning. And brilliantly, in his trial, the judge said, well, I presume that you were brought in to add an air of respectability to the whole affair. And he replied, not in the least. I do odd jobs for a bookmaker, sweeping up and so forth. So he was sort of aware of how much he'd fallen on hard times, but I sort of wanted to bring him up because he's sort of the most typical disreputable knight that I could find.
He's like a 20th century knights become like rogues.
Yeah, exactly.
You reminded me of the current Earl of Sandwich, John Montague, who's the 11th Earl, talking of people trading off the family name.
Does he have the trademark on it?
The Earl of Sandwich took advantage of his predecessor, the 4th Earl, after whom the sandwich is apparently named. He has licensed the use of his title for a chain of sandwich shops called Earl of Sandwich Shops.
Oh my God.
Around the United States, including in the Disney Springs Marketplace in Walt Disney World, in an agreement with a guy who, interestingly, his name is Robert Earl, who is the founder of the Planet Hollywood chain. Yeah, he's licensed the Earl of Sandwich name.
It's the beautiful place where feudalism and neoliberalism collide.
Disneyland. Yeah. We've got a castle.
Perfect. Next up, we've got the 7th Baronet of Shrewsbury, Sir Edward Atoll Oakley. He went to Clifton School. He also went to Sandhurst. He served in the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. But he
The Oxen Bucks.
Yeah.
I once saw a buxom ox.
But he came to fame after World War One as one of Britain's greatest freestyle wrestlers.
What?
Yeah. He got into freestyle wrestling after
after World War One.
Yeah. No, that's not like how he fought World War One.
Yeah, he thought World War One was one big massive mud wrestler. Yeah. I
got confused. Ah, the sun was so sexy.
That's a sentence that's never been said ever on this planet.
The mud, the wrestling, the weirdly skimpy outfits. I came back and I turned to baby oil. And it wasn't the same. Call me Tommy.
Don't you have to call him S. Pro Patria body slam. So this is in 1920s back in England.
So 1920s, he gets involved in a bar fight with a bunch of sailors.
And it's freestyle, guys!
Yeah.
In the war, wrestling just happened everywhere. Is that not how it works back home?
Pretty much, and it basically, he discovers a talent for wrestling. He's only 5'9", he's a little guy.
That's good.
He builds his body up by drinking 11 pints of milk a day.
Oh, for the 3 days.
No exercise, 11 pints of milk.
Yes.
The 20s.
The reason he did it is because he'd read about the German wrestling champion, George Hackenschmidt, apparently doing the same, 11 pints of milk a day. However, what he read was a misprint, and it was actually 1 pint a day.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
George Hackenschmidt's, he changed a lot of the business.
Well, as did Sir Edward Atoll Oakley. He sort of skirted the line between genuine competitive wrestling and laying down the foundations for what we know of professional wrestling in this country.
Eddie Oakley?
Yeah, Teddy
old
Oakley.
Teddy Oaks.
Yeah, what a good old lad he was. He once fought a 7'6" Turkish wrestler and put him in a half Nelson so tight they had to go to hospital and be untangled. He claimed once to have fought a 9-foot wrestler, but didn't have any evidence of it anywhere. Between 1930 and 35, he fought 2,000 bouts. He was the UK heavyweight champion between those years, the European champion in 1932, and went on a 17-bout unbeaten streak in America.
We just worked out how many pints of milk that was he'd ingested in that time.
Yeah, if he's drinking 11 pints of milk a day for those 5 years, 20,086 pints of milk.
Think how many cows he's gone through. God almighty. Obviously, when he got turned into like a big, hefty wrestler, he would just pick up the cow and suckle directly from it until it squeezed dry.
Throwing it over his shoulder. His pile of udderless cows. I wish this was a visual meeting for everyone to see Paul's desiccated cow look.
He actually returned to wrestling after a wee hiatus at the end of the 1930s, and this is a great report from A Year in Wrestling. Pandemonium broke out in Nottingham today when Atoll Oakley returned to the ring following his retirement some years earlier. Oakley's opponent was the villainous, hard-boiled Herbie Rosenberg. Trouble started with Rosenberg's opposition to the referee of the contest, resulting in Cab Cashford brought in as a substitute third man. The crowd booed and called for a new referee as Oakley took a beating, only for fortunes to change as Oakley recovered to deliver 2 quick punches, knocking out both Rosenberg and the referee.
That's pro wrestling.
That's pro wrestling.
Amazing.
That's right, isn't it?
You can see it to work.
It's remarkable. Remember, he comes from an aristocratic background. The title of his autobiography is Blue Blood on the Mat.
Oh, good.
Great, isn't it?
That's going on the Amazon list.
Yeah, so, but he is not my suggestion. My suggestion...
He's too good.
He's too good. Yeah. I mean, I'm bringing shame to the baronetcy of Shrewsbury, but...
Man. When you can have a wrestling breakout at any moment. Yeah.
But my suggestion for the world's worst night is Sir George Reresby Sitwell, and he is the father of Edith Sitwell.
Right.
The author and her brothers Osbert and Sacharel. Those names should be a clue as to this man's lunacy.
Yeah.
He lived from 1860 to 1943, an astonishingly arrogant man who lived in his own weird and wonderful world of inventions, scholarship, and hypochondria. And not only did he have hypochondria for himself, he had hypochondria for his children as well.
All right.
And at one point, he forced Edith to wear a back brace and a nose tunnel for no reason whatsoever.
To make her sit well.
Obviously. Nominative determinism has lived in this family for year upon year and century upon century. Amongst his many idiosyncratic inventions, he invented a musical toothbrush.
That's just a flute with a sting strapped to it.
An egg made of smoked meat and rice that was hidden within a synthetic shell.
Scotch egg.
Yeah.
Scotch egg, yeah.
And a tiny revolver for shooting wasps.
did he invent a second one for shooting bees? Because they're very, very different.
Now I guess you're wondering, have I fired five shots? I'll see. No, I'm sorry, I don't speak well.
We're going on a wasp hunt. We're going to catch a big one.
Yeah. I missed the wasp and struck an innocent fly. I'll never hunt again. It's a ladybird holding another ladybird. Was aiming for the wasp. So sorry.
Then later, little hordes of ladybirds and ants and bees campaigning for gun control among the aristocracy.
Yeah, I mean,
all invertebrates matter.
Why don't you buzz off?
Like, most aristocracy like to hunt big game, but not old George Resby Sitwell.
Oh, God, you didn't have a wall of, like, wasp heads.
Hang on, sorry, one second. How big was the gun that he could pull the trigger on it?
I don't know, it's probably one of those tiny little ones.
So then presumably has to wig up some sort of thing with string to pull the trigger on it? Or is it a massive gun with a tiny
bullet? Tell me where your nest is. Tell me where the nest is. Hang on, someone get me a cocktail stick, I can't cock it.
Or normal sized gun, tiny bullet.
I can't load it, I've dropped them all.
Nobody move!
Nobody move. Nobody I move. Think I've swallowed my gun. My mistake.
God.
He also was obsessed with designing and redesigning the landscape around his familial home. Mm. So he would move entire lakes and trees, and at one point had to be dissuaded from painting blue Chinese willow patterns on the cows.
Wow. He sounds like Mad King Ludwig of Bavaria.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure he's got the same sort of business. This is the brilliant thing about him. He was nuts, but he was also an academic as well.
To who?
To himself.
I've arrived at university my first day. I'm taking wasp shooting. Oh, Professor Sitwell. On the table is a jammy dodger, and nobody else, you walk in, you go, what? You walk up to it, you see a dead wasp, you pick up the gun, and behind it, the door swings open and just...
Sitwell's there dressed in yellow and black.
Yes.
The thing is, and the reason why one of my reasons he's my world's worst night, he lived in the 19th, the 20th century, but he was obsessed with medieval times. Mm. And it's bad enough for the Earl of Essex to be obsessed, but that was in the late 1500s, early 1600s. This guy was 300 years further on. Mm. So his academic work showed this. Some of his great works include Wool Gathering Medieval Times and Since.
Wool Gathering.
Wool Gathering. Mm-hmm.
The sequel to Sheep Chasing.
Yeah. And the prequel to Cow Tipping. Acorns as an Article of Medieval Diet. And the absolute...
That's fair. That's reasonable.
And the absolute classic, The Leper's Squint.
Lovely.
This is how
Harry Potter and the
yeah, absolutely. He was so obsessed with the 14th century, he insisted on paying anyone who worked for his estate in kind. So when he sent his children to Eton, he sent for his payment pigs and potatoes.
Oh God! Or the guy who's his gamekeeper brings him a couple of ducks that he's brought a Ziploc bag of wasps. In response. Your family and you shall feast for a week.
It's guys like that, though. They always have this idea of, like, we must go with the chivalry. The chivalric code, the guy who espoused it the most in England was Richard the Lionheart, right? It's supposed to be Richard Lionheart. Do you know what happened on Richard the Lionheart's death? So he was besieging a castle in France. Mm-hmm. And he stepped out from behind a palisade, and a kitchen boy took a pot shot at him with a crossbow, and it hit him in the shoulder, and he died a few days later. But he knew he was dying because he had septicemia. The castle had fallen at this point, and he asked for the boy who'd shot him to come to his tent. He pardoned him.
Oh, that's good.
He pardoned him and gave him 100 shillings.
Mm.
And it was just...
the mad like, old fucker.
Yeah. Ah, you scamp, away with you.
Exactly. This is the idea of this chivalric kind of code. And he was like, we was in battle, it was fair, and I forgive you. King died. He had a mercenary captain called Mercadier or something like that. And the mercenary captain went, ha, that chivalry's fun. Okay, take the money off the kid and skin him. And that's actually what happened.
Classic. Amazing.
George Sitwell was not, I mean, he was nowhere near that sort of vicious, but he was nuts. Electricity was banned at Eckington Manor, so all they used was cold boiled water, no wine and candles.
Well, hang on, I'm calling bullshit on this for a second, just on his plan. All right, no electricity, but I will have a revolver for wasps. Dad, that has cordite in the... Nope, some things we can have, some things we can't have.
All right, fine. He had a tiny crossbow for wasps. Are you happy?
I'm not happy. The gun's much funnier.
He bought a villa in Italy, or a castle called the Castello di Monteguafoni in Florence, but it was an absolute ruin. He was joined on his sojourn there to try and restore the house by his valet called Moat. And he insisted that Moat still laid out formal evening wear for him every evening.
He insisted that he ran around the castle at all times. We want a wet Moat. Get sweating.
Someone wants to invade us. Hang on, let Moat arrive. I'll be around. Lay down, Moat.
Sorry, my lord. They're on both sides. Oh, God.
I want to fortify Moat. Make him swallow two alligators.
My final...
Drown that man, Moat! Drown him! Got a glass of water, he's just holding his head. Right on it, your lordship!
I've got two final facts about this mad old bastard. Firstly, a quote from him that shows really how stubborn and headstrong he was with his insanity. He said, "I must ask anyone entering the house never to contradict me in any way, as it interferes with the functioning of the gastric juices and may prevent me sleeping at night."
So if he said, "Oh, it's nice weather," you're saying, "Well, I think it's going to get a bit rainy later on." He would be up all night. Fuck.
Yeah, exactly.
You shouldn't eat that bag of wasps. Oh, yeah. I'm going to have indigestion now because you contradicted me.
No, I rather think it's going to be the wasps, Father.
No, it's the contradiction.
But last of all, my favourite fact, we've shown what an absolute wasp shit crazy man he is. His children, in order to get away with him, invented a yacht.
What?
They invented a yacht that
they sailed across Mr. Moat.
Yeah. And they decided, in order to make the lie believable, this yacht was called the Rover, and they even went as far as making headed notepaper for it to convince their father.
Oh, wait. So they pretended they were away yachting when they were just staying in the hotel in the village?
Pretty much,
That's amazing.
Oh, when you say invented a yacht, I was sort of like, did anyone not tell them the yachts already existed? Do you want one extra fact that I found no other reason to have it?
Go on.
Charles the Bald's best friend was William the Hairy.
Oh, I smell a sitcom.
I'm just glad they found each other.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Charles the Bald was from a family of barbers, but William the Hairy was only friends with surgeons.
So, our suggestions for the world's worst night are the hopeless romantic Ulrich von Liechtenstein.
Yeah.
The hopeless, square-bearded Elizabeth I botherer, Bobby Devereux, the second Earl of Essex.
Bobby Devereux,
yeah. And the absolute hat-stand mental Sir George Sitwell.
Now, I don't want to bend your arm, Ben, but I love George Sitwell.
I don't want to bend your arm either, but wasp gun!
Fair enough, I'm not going to stand in your way of choosing him. Fair enough, I'm taking it. Sir George Sitwell is the world's worst knight. So before we go, it's time for the world's worst news. And we go to Denver in America, where an off-duty FBI agent who was dancing wildly at a downtown bar accidentally shot a man in the leg when the agent tried to pick up a gun that fell from its holster as he performed a handstand.
He performed a handstand.
Yeah, he was actually
How
in a drama
was
school.
He?
Yeah.
So he did a handstand. The gun fell out. Didn't go off at that point.
No, and then he picked it up and that's when it went off.
Oh my goodness.
And a passing wasp dropped down dead.
So, Paul, before we go, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
All right, they go to my Twitter. They can find me at Paul Duncan McG, or if you would like to hear my more academically minded podcast, Ask an Archaeologist or Ask an Arc on Twitter.
It's very good. Recommend it highly. I have actually listened, unlike some guests' podcasts when you have to on the show.
And if you manage to find yourself in Edinburgh during the 2018 festival, I am unsurprisingly doing a show called A Practical Guide to Attacking Castles.
If the title alone doesn't get you in the door, I mean, nothing will.
Marvellous. Well, we're all off to raise the Fourth Armada. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Could you check the weather forecast?
Good point.
Whoa, good steed. Thanks for the ride, Ben. That was so much fun. And after waiting, what, about 6 months to reschedule it, it was well worth the wait, wasn't it?
Damn right. I mean, I don't want to slap my own back, but goddamn wasp guns.
Yeah.
I'm delighted with that.
That fact kept. That was, yeah. That's a story you've had in your pocket since we researched the podcast months ago. It's nice that we finally got it in. Do check out Paul's podcast. Find him on Twitter. Go see him live.
Too right. Oh, and also, if you are a London-based podcast listener, Paul will be doing his last London preview at my comedy club, Good Ship Comedy, on July the 30th. Tickets for that are available as we speak.
Do the usual stuff. Yep. Find us on our website, www.worstfootforwardpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter, at worstfoot. Find Ben is at Ben Vandeveld. I'm at Baz Max Day. We're on Facebook and iTunes and all those other places as well. And you can send an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch.
It's rate and review time, guys, and let's not mess around. As you will know from having just listened to this episode, we're friends with a 6'4" Yorkshireman who owns a suit of armour and a sword.
Two suits of armour.
Two suits of armour, yeah. Really good point. So if you don't leave us a review, we will send him round to your house to threaten you.
I am in a play this month in London, which opens tonight at the Bunker Theatre in London Bridge. It's Libby's Eyes is the name of the play. We're running tonight, which is a Monday, and the upcoming Thursday, and then the next Monday and next Thursday. We're running Mondays and Thursdays from tonight on the 11th of June for the next 4 weeks. So come find us, Libby's Eyes, the Bunker Theatre.
Magic. Who have we got on next week, Barry?
Next week, our guest is the playwright Tristan Bernays, good friend of yours and mine. Relatively recently had a play called Boudicca at the Globe Theatre in London, so he's a proper good playwright in that.
Mm.
And he's chosen a literary subject of sorts for our topic. We're going to do the world's worst sex scene, and then we're going to record a podcast about the world's worst sex scene. So tune in for us getting sexy next week on Worstwood Forward. Ben is creased up in horror.
That's my favourite position.
Worstfoot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worstfoot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.